Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to Millennial Love, a podcast from The Independent on everything to do with love, sexuality, identity and more. This week I'm thrilled to be joined by author Jodie Chapman. Jodie's debut novel, Another Life, tells the story of Nick and Anna, who meet when they're young one summer and working at the same cinema. The thing is, Nick and Anna come from two very different backgrounds, as we soon discover. Anna is a Jehovah's Witness, as Jodie was. In this episode, Jodie spoke to me about how her own childhood influenced the plot of her novel and how her religious upbringing shaped the way she thought about sex and relationships. We also spoke about celibacy, how religion can act as a barrier in relationships, and misconceptions around doomsday religions. Enjoy the show! Hi Jodie, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks Olivia, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you. I haven't actually spoken to anyone on the show about a novel for a long time. So it's a real treat. We normally have people coming on talking about like memoirs and stuff, but this is why I think your book is so interesting, because obviously it's heavily influenced by your own experiences, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. The book Another Life, it's a love story. It is marketed as a love story, but it's very much a story about love in general, and it explores romantic love, but it also explores the bond between siblings, and the bond between parent and child, and the bond between husbands and wives themselves. And the character of Anna, she belongs to I'll use shorthand, a doomsday religion, which is never actually named in the novel, but it is heavily influenced by my own upbringing as a Jehovah's Witness. And that is a faith that I was born into and I was in all my life, until when I started having children, when I was about 29, 30, the doubts that I had always had sort of started coming back to the forefront of my mind. And I felt I had to engage with those in a way. But the religion in the book, I never name the religion in the book out of respect to my family who are still active members of the faith. But it was such an interesting, I had a lot to draw on in my own experience of growing up, because it is a faith that you can't step out of. You can't include people who are outside the community in your life to any kind of meaningful extent, really. So there was a lot of conflict there that I always thought would make a good novel. So even though, the relationship in it is fictional, but I have drawn on the conflict that I felt growing up as an believer, where I would have feelings for unbelievers.
I want to start off by talking a bit about your upbringing then, because I think in order for listeners to understand the context within which the novel sits, it's kind of helpful to get a deeper understanding of how, you know, being part of that community influenced your attitudes towards sex and relationships when you were growing up. So if you could just, at a very basic level, for those who don't understand what a doomsday religion is, just explain what exactly that means and how it impacts and how it impacted your kind of day-to-day life when you were growing up.
So Jehovah's Witnesses are a religion that believe, they're a Christian religion, and they believe that any day the end of the world is coming. And they have felt that that has been the narrative ever since the religion first came about in the late 1800s. And they believe that the end of the world will come any day, and that only Jehovah's Witnesses will pass through Armageddon, which is the judgment day. Everyone else who has not listened to the message and has not become a witness will be destroyed. And this is something that they take extremely seriously. And The ministry, which is where you go from door to door and you knock on strangers' doors and you preach to them this message, is a huge part of the life of a witness. So I grew up with ministry being something I did every single weekend of my life. So my parents would take me from door to door and we would spend an hour on a Saturday morning preaching to people in the hope of getting them to listen to the message and ultimately save their life. Because obviously it's something that you're doing every single weekend, it forms such a huge part of your life that you have to, the faith, it's there every single day. I mean, you pray before meals, you pray before bedtime, you have three meetings a week. When I was a child, you had three meetings a week you went to, which was a Sunday morning, a Tuesday evening, and a Thursday evening. And you would go to the local Kingdom Hall, which is what witnesses call a church, and you would listen to different talks, and you would get advice there about how to overcome conversation stoppers, how to keep people's interest. I mean, there was a lot of great training, to be honest, in terms of public speaking at these meetings. But the narrative was always the end of the world is coming any day. And so that has such a huge effect on your life when you're growing up, because it affects every decision. So education, you get the most basic level of education, and that's meant to be it. You are not supposed to go to university. It's extremely frowned upon if you go to university, and parents of people who do go to university would be spoken to within the congregation. You know, why are you allowing your child to do this? The end of the world is coming any day. What is the point of seeking a career for ourselves when really our lives should be all about the message?
This might sound like a daft question,
no,
but
go ahead.
Presumably, if the education level was so basic, was there any degree of education about sex and relationships at all? I mean, sex ed within, you know, the general sector is already pretty rubbish. It's only just been updated, but I wonder if that was ever spoken about at all, or was it, how did that kind of message come across?
It was, but it was something that you were spoken about very freely from the platform at the Kingdom Hall at the meetings. So you would grow up, you know, you'd be there with your parents as a family in the audience, and you'd be listening, and they would always be talking about sex in terms of how there's no premarital sex. So you cannot have sex before marriage. And, you know, they would frown upon masturbation. Homosexuality was absolutely unacceptable. That's considered evil and very much wrong. You know, when I say that, it wouldn't be that they would feel, they wouldn't be hateful towards people who were gay, in the sense that, you know, for example, the Westboro Baptist Church in America who picket, you know, there would be none of that.
Say the Louis Theroux documentary.
There's none of that. It's not hateful in that sense, but it's absolutely unacceptable. It's just flat out not allowed. So there wouldn't be any Sunday school. You would be there in the meeting and you'd just listen to things being spoken about. And, they would talk about sex and relationships in that way. But it was very much fundamentalist. So it followed the Bible in terms of you had to be a virgin when you got married. You could not marry an unbeliever because God frowns upon the yoking together of two people who are not of the same faith. I mean, you could marry an unbeliever, but it would be frowned upon. But you absolutely could not live with someone, for example, before you got married. You have to get married. So a lot of people get married young. And there would always, you know, I remember being a child, it sounds so strange now that I'm not an active member of that community, and now I'm raising my own children. It blows my mind sometimes when I think about what I was told. I was always told that I would never grow up in this system. I would, by the time I was a grown up, we would be in paradise. Armageddon would have come. We would have passed through into paradise. I would never finish school. This is what the adults used to tell me. There was always in the back of my mind something like, okay, well, I'll believe it when I see it. I was quite a gobby kid, and I would always, you know, second guess things and ask questions, and I'd ask too many questions sometimes. But it's really interesting. You're taught the answers before you're old enough to start asking the questions. So all these things I just absorbed, because these are the things that the people that I loved most in the world were telling me. You know, you don't go to university, you don't seek a career, and material aspirations for yourself, because that's just that's selfish. That's what independent worldly people do. Anyone who's not part of the community is worldly, a worldly person. There's a very specific lingo that you have when you're a witness. You talk about yourself and everyone else who's a believer as being in the truth. So every single day, you're constantly reaffirming to yourself that you are part of God's chosen people and that you are part of the truth. And if you, you know, if you're telling someone a story and you say, oh, they screwed me over or something, and then go, well, they're a worldly person, aren't they? That's what worldly people do. They screw each other over. So there was always this very, very strong emphasis on how unbelievers will ultimately, that they do not have your best interests at heart. Those friends at school, they're not your friends. They don't actually care about you. The people within your bubble, I mean, they don't use the word bubble, but the people within the truth is how they call it. Those are the people who are really there for you. And I grew up absorbing that sort of thinking. It was very prevalent every single day. You know, there were, I would look the same on the outside. You know, you would look at me and not think that there was anything different about me. We dress the same as everyone else. You know, we go to school, we go to work, we have normal lives, but inside it is very different.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting parallel with Anna, isn't it? It's like from the outside, you know, you would never know. She just looks like a normal girl who works in the cinema when Nick meets her. So I want to talk a bit about the dynamics in your household and how this kind of influenced the way that you thought about love. You mentioned that you were like a gobby child. So when you grew up and you started to become a teenager, like how much of things did you start to question? You know, you wrote in a piece recently about the dynamics in your household being very much like dictated by this idea of patriarchy. Did you kind of just go along with all of that, or was there a part of you that was resisting? And I suppose particularly when it came to dating, because you do date as a teenager, right? And there's no sex before marriage, but you still date.
You date. Witnesses hate the word date because they see that as a worldly word, because to date is a very casual term, when actually you do not even entertain the idea of being in a relationship with someone until you are in a position where you are ready for marriage. And so if you're 15, 16, there's no dating then, because you're not allowed to get married. When you're at school, you don't have a job, you can't afford a house for yourself. You know, you cannot go out with anyone. So it's very firm about things like that. So before you get married, you have to be in a certain position. So before you even start thinking about going out with someone, you have to be in a position where you're relatively self-sufficient and you could, you know, look after each other. I did always question it. I always found, I've always questioned patriarchy. I've never completely accepted it, because, you know, I love my parents very deeply. They had a very traditional gender roles. I think part of that is also the generation that they were. It was much more normal back then for there to be these very clearly delineated roles within the household. But I grew up always questioning it, never, I think, because my personality as well is I'm more like my dad, who says what he thinks and he's quite outspoken, and my mum is very silent anyway. She's a very quiet person, and I'm definitely more like my dad than I am my mum. So I would struggle with that, because within their dynamics I would struggle to see how I could ever be like my mum, because I naturally wasn't meek and submissive, which is very much how women are meant to be within the faith. And that's talked about a lot in the literature, in the talks that you listen to at Kingdom Halls. Whenever they're talking about the role of the husband and the wife, the husband is the one that makes the decision, always. And the woman is meek and submissive. She does not question her husband's authority. Even if, you know, they would say things like, even where the wife perhaps is more intelligent than the husband, she knows that her God-given place is to just support him anyway, even if he does something that she doesn't agree with. And I always struggled with that, because it just did not come naturally to me. At the same time, there was a part of me that desperately wanted to be like that, because it was all I'd ever known. And it's so much easier to fit in if you're able to just do those things naturally. So I always had this conflict within myself, and that Anna is fictional. I mean, it would be ridiculous for me to say she's absolutely not me, because of course there's elements of my experience in there, but I deliberately didn't write from her perspective because I didn't want it to be autobiographical. But I did always have that conflict where I would question these things and I would say, but that doesn't feel right to me and I don't agree with that. But at the same time, I'd be like, oh, why can't I just be like that? Why can't I just be quiet and just, you know, get along with it? So that was always something that I had within myself. But there would be certain things I would question, like, for example, women can wear trousers, but they can't wear the trousers. They can't wear the trousers literally and figuratively. They can't wear trousers to meetings and they can't wear trousers on the ministry when they're knocking on doors. They have to wear a dress or a skirt. And I would always be like, where does it say this in the Bible? Like, every single rule I want to see in the Bible, because if that's how we have to live our lives, you can't be adding extra rules in, because otherwise, how is that fair? Like, anyone could then come up with a rule and everyone else has to obey it. That's not right. But that questioning is not encouraged within the faith. You are not encouraged to be questioning. I think that's partly why university is discouraged, because it teaches you to think for yourself and it teaches you to look at all the evidence. And ultimately, you're meant to just kind of follow the pattern of everyone who's come before you and not question things. To question things is a, you know, who do you think you are? Getting above your station.
Yeah. God, it's really fascinating. You know, I think myself included, it's something that so few people really know that much about. I think apart from, like you mentioned, Westboro Church, like those really extreme examples where it's like you think of like the protests and the picketing and stuff. It's like, it's really interesting to hear about it in such depth. And I think that's one of the reasons as well why the book will be so fascinating to so many people, because it just, and again, I like that you write from Nick's perspective, because I think it lends itself to the story to see Anna as like an outsider. Like, that's kind of the way that it sets itself up, but then as it goes along, it becomes a little bit more integrated. So you mentioned that people within your community get married very young, and I know you got married when you were 21, so talk to me a bit about that. How did you meet your husband, and was that, presumably that was the first relationship you were in? And I guess, you know, you mentioned that no one really dates because the view is always to be in a relationship, but like, is there a period of sort of just seeing if you guys can, you know, get along to get enough to get married? Like, how quick is that process?
Yeah, I mean, it's different for different people. Like, I got married at 21, which in the eyes of quote unquote worldly people is very young, but within the faith itself, it's not. That's just totally normal age. You know, I knew 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds who got married. So to me, it was not especially young. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? You compare yourself with people that you know and what's known within your community. So, I mean, my husband and I, we met when I was about 19, and you're not allowed to date in the sense that you can't go out on dates on your own. So you're not meant to go out unchaperoned. So you're meant to get to know each other within groups. So you get together within groups of friends and you get one-on-one within a group scenario so that you're not ever tempted. And we didn't always stick to that, to be honest. We got to know each other through mutual friends, but there were on occasions times where we would just go out on our own. We went to the cinema, which was also a no-no. You're not meant to go to cinema, because even though you're in public, you know, it's a dark space, what's gonna go on? And I remember we went to see the film Cold Mountain, and we walked in as the trailers had started, and it was like really busy screening, and I could see some seats at the back sort of kind of in the corner, and I was like, oh, let's go up there. So of course it's all dark, the trailers are playing, and we go up and we, you know, have to, excuse me, sorry, we just gotta get through there, you know, people are like moving themselves. And anyway, in the row that we're pushing past are two elders from the hall, and the elders are the group of men that are like in charge of things, and we had to like push past them to get to our seats. And I just remember us just like laughing, like, oh my goodness, we're going to be in such big trouble because we're here at the cinema on our own. I mean, talking about it now, we were both like 20. Like, it's crazy. It's so crazy. But it is that thing where that's how it goes in that community, and you don't step out of that. So we got to know each other we got to know each other when friends were around. We had a big group of mutual friends. So we went out for about 2 years, 2.5 years, and then before we got married. So, which is actually quite a long time within that community to get to know each other. It's totally standard. And bearing in mind, we're not living with each other here. And there's only a certain amount you still know each other. You don't actually know what the other person is like in terms of living with that person and seeing what they're like when the shutters are down and they're not on their best behavior all the time.
But yeah, the living together thing is really interesting because I've seen a lot of conversations generally about people talking about couples who move in together only after they got married. I think it's like a modern trend where people actually just aren't living together until they do get married. But I agree with you. I think it makes, I mean, personally, I feel like, you know, there are too many surprises if you just move in with someone.
Totally. Well, actually, that first year that my husband and I were married, like, I would not want to repeat that for anything because we'd never even lived away from our parents before. We had no experience of being independent. And all of a sudden we're trying to deal with that, like learning how you navigate life, like buying your own food at a supermarket and paying your council tax. And at the same time, also getting to know each other on a day in, day out basis. And it's just, oh my goodness, it's so crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you have to like get to know each other on a completely different level. It's a risk. You know, it sounds kind of chic in a way to be like, oh yeah, we're just going to move in together now once we're married and it's all going to be, you know, glamorous and lovely. But it's like, really?
Yeah.
Is it? So I know that having children of your own was like quite a big game changer for you in terms of the way that you viewed your life as a witness. You have three sons now, right?
That's right. So
What was it about having your children that kind of triggered that change in perception for you?
So I always had doubts about it. When I say doubts, I mean, there were always things that I thought, I don't quite know about that, or that doesn't sound right to me. For example, like the ban on women wearing trousers. And there were just certain little things that I justified to myself and just thought, well, that these things are bound to happen. It's not going to be perfect. They're not going to have got everything right because it is a man-made thing as well. They're trying to do their best. But of course, there's going to be things that they don't quite get right, but that will be sorted out one day. You know, when Armageddon comes and God restores the earth as to how it needs to be, all these things will be sorted out. So there's going to be quibbles, but it was nothing big enough to rock the boat. But there were always certain things that I just didn't understand, certain parts of the doctrine. And I would really try, like I would ask the elders within the congregation questions about the doctrines in an attempt to understand it, because I just didn't see the proof in the Bible for some of the beliefs. And I really wanted to believe it. I really wanted to prove it to myself, because as I said before about, you know, wanting to play that role, it's so much easier if you can just believe what you're told. It's so much easier if you can just go along with that, because the faith is so insular. And I have a huge amount of respect for the faith still, and all my family and my friends who are still in it, many of whom I no longer have anything to do with. I still have a huge amount of love for them and respect for them. So I never mean any disrespect to them or the community when I talk about it. I'm just very much aware it's my experience. And I think it's important that I'm able to own my experience and talk about it without them necessarily taking it personally as me dissing them. But having children just completely changed my mindset, because for years I just coasted along because it was the easy thing to do. Because what's the alternative? I leave my entire community. I leave all my family and all my friends who are witnesses. I leave everything I've ever known and I essentially start again. I mean, that I'm quite an assertive person, but even that for me was a bit like, I don't know if I can face that. But then when I started having children, that changed everything, because all of a sudden I couldn't coast along anymore. I was now responsible for teaching them how to live. And it's not the kind of faith, it's not the kind of, you know, certain Anglican faiths, I think, give you a lot of freedom in the sense that you can live your life Monday to Saturday, however you want, and then you go to church on a Sunday. And that is the extent of it. And it's not faith like that. As I said before, it's all consuming. There is a rule, whether official or unofficial, for every aspect of your life, from what color you dye your hair. You know, if you dyed your hair pink or blue, you'd be spoken to. That wouldn't be allowed. Because if you're going on the ministry, knocking on people's doors, you're presenting yourself, you're presenting God's message. You have to have natural hair color. You know, you can't wear certain things, you can't do certain jobs. So I wanted to be a film critic when I was younger. I was talked out of that because I'd have to watch films with sex and violence in, which would be very inappropriate. You know, your education, the things you do for entertainment, everything. You can't really do a gap year because you'd be away from meetings and ministry for a whole year. And why would you do that when the end of the world is coming and you need to be preaching the message? And I just realized that having children, I would have to bring them up in this way of life where I'm not allowed to pick and choose the rules that I follow. You can't do that. It's just flat out not allowed. So I would have to, for example, there's a rule on birthdays. You're not allowed to celebrate your birthday. So witnesses don't celebrate most celebrations that regular people celebrate. They don't do Christmas, Easter, Valentine's Day, bonfire night, Halloween, or birthdays. The only thing you can really celebrate is your wedding anniversary, which I always thought was a shame. If you're single and you're not married, you don't get to celebrate anything, basically. And also, an anniversary to me is the same as a birthday. You're commemorating the year since something happened. And I never understood the ban on birthdays. That never made sense to me. I always found the reasoning extremely flimsy. But I couldn't openly celebrate birthdays. And I didn't care about celebrating my birthday because I never had done. So I couldn't miss what I'd never known. But I felt that with my children, they would go to school and I would have to, every September, I'd have to go in. And I have three kids, so I'd have to do this with three different teachers every single year, explain to them why they don't do birthdays, why if children bring in sweets and treats because it's their birthday and they want to share them with their school friends, my children can't have them. My children can't write Mother's Day cards, Father's Day cards. They can't do anything Christmas related, anything Easter related. And some of these celebrations I agreed with why, if you believed in the Bible, you couldn't celebrate, but a lot of them I didn't. And I just thought I would have to explain this, talking as if I absolutely believe this. And I thought, I don't know what I believe. I have huge doubts and I still don't know what I think about meaning of life and God and all that. And I thought, I can't ban things from my children's life unless I completely agree with the ban. It's not my right to do that. And the fact that I have these doubts about this way of life would make it even worse, because in a way I just saw it as a type of abuse of my role as a parent, from my fear of stepping outside my community and questioning things would be preventing me from doing my job as a parent. So it was very strange how, as soon as I thought about it like that, the decision was made for me. I just thought, well, Jodie, you have no choice now. You have to step away from this because it's not about you anymore. You don't get to just, and it's funny, this had always been my fear about having children. And for quite a lot of my 20s, I never wanted kids, was because the thought of being so responsible for someone else and unable to just live my life how I saw it terrified me. And now I had my children who I adored and who I loved more than anything in the world. I had to do what was right for them. And I thought, even if we kind of sit on the fringes of the faith and we go along and we have the community and we have our friends and our family and we kind of not massively in it, I still couldn't celebrate birthdays. I still couldn't do little things like that. And I decided that it was, although they're silly little things, also for me to turn these things down, there needs to be a valid reason. Otherwise, I'm lying to myself. I'm lying to my children. If God is there, I'm lying to God. And I'm lying to all my family and friends. So in the end, I felt I had no choice but to step away.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip? elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It makes so much sense that it was when you had children that that kind of became the point when you decided that, because I think so many people, when they go through something as a child, you know, something that doesn't feel quite right with them, whether it's, you know, a religious belief or you know, maybe you see the way that you don't like the way that you're being parented or something. I feel like whenever that person then has their own children, if they do, you see it as a kind of opportunity to like rectify it in a way. And it's like taking control of it. I mean, I don't have kids, so I'm just talking hypothetically, but that is what I'm kind of understanding from what you're saying.
It definitely is. And I think I just wanted my children to have freedom. I wanted them not necessarily to do all of those things that I couldn't do, and that if I stayed in the faith they couldn't do, because some of the things, you know, just because I'm no longer an active member of that religion, it doesn't mean that I've embraced every custom that was banned to me before. That's been the wonderful thing now, is that I'm living consciously, I'm not just on autopilot, and I can pick and choose the things that I want to practice, both within my family and within my home. But the important thing to me is that my children have choice, that they are raised with the ability to question things, and that's okay, that it's okay to change your mind when you are presented with new evidence, that is actually the wonderful thing about being a human being, that we have this conscious thought, and that the decision that we made when we were a child, we don't have to stick to that. If actually our instinct and our gut is telling us, no, you need to listen to something else now, it would be wrong to disregard that evidence and those new instincts just to make everyone else's life, i.e. your family and your friends, just to make everyone else's life easier. I just think that would be what kind of example would I be setting to my children if I lived my life in fear and was half living that life, if that makes sense, not fully embracing it. What kind of a life is that to live, where you're not actually fully embracing the life that you have?
How old are your sons now?
So my eldest is 8 and my second son is 6 and my youngest son is about to turn 3.
Okay, so they're too young to be talking about sex and relationships too, but I want to ask if that is something that you have thought about at all, and how you will broach that subject with them when they do get to that age where they start dating. You know, have you, based on your own upbringing, have you given that some consideration?
I have, and I've told my 8-year-old you know, how babies are made. I've told him that, because I don't think it's right for the responsibility of that education to be at the mercy of his school friends. I don't want him to find that information out from his school friends. And now with, you know, how rampant porn is now, having 3 sons, I don't want them to find out what sex is through porn, because that's not really what sex is. It's so performative, and I'm not here to diss porn, but I do think that the easy availability of it in our culture now, I don't agree with that at all. I think that is fundamentally wrong, that children are able to access these things. And I don't want my children, you know, it would be ridiculous and naive of me to think that my sons are never going to see that, because of course they will. But I know that I need to get in there first. So even separate from the aspect of religion and how I was brought up, I think the time that children are growing up now is far different to when I was a kid in the 80s and the 90s. And it's my responsibility to react to that. So I've already told him how babies are made, you know, and I use the technical words for the genitalia, and just talking about it very matter of fact. And I'm not at all like, ooh, you know, this way that people do with sex sometimes, I think, if you're in a very religious household, sometimes you just don't talk about it at all. And I don't want to be like that. I want to be a very open house. And I want to talk about these things with my sons. And I'm sure they'll find it embarrassing talking about these things with their mum as they get older. But I'm starting right now to talk about these things so that it's just normal. I don't want anything to be taboo in my family of where they say, oh, I can't talk about that. I want it to be open and honest. And then as they get older, you know, I've already made the decision, for example, that my boys aren't going to have iPhones. So like when they go to school, they'll have a phone, but it will be very basic and they're not going to have access to internet. And of course, they're going to be shown things by their school friends, but that's fine. You know, but as long as I'm making sure that they're not addicted to their screens, because who knows what they're learning and absorbing through that way. You know, so I suppose I am still going to be, I do still think I'm going to be quite a strict parent, in the sense that maybe a lot of parents in a religious upbringing have as well. But I would rather, I think as long as I go through it with the ethos of, well, we can talk about everything, then that's fine. And that's the other thing is, you know, if my sons turn out to be gay, I wouldn't have wanted to have raised them in an environment that would basically be shutting down that part of them and saying, no, that's not acceptable. I don't want that. I want my children to just grow up with the freedom really to think for themselves. And of course I'm there as their parent guiding them at the moment and telling them how I think the best way to live is. But ultimately, whenever they ask me questions about things, because they ask me questions all the time, they're both at that stage now, the older ones, I say what I think and I say, well, what do you think? So that we're all talking about our opinions and that we're all giving our opinions, you know, just because I feel like this doesn't mean you have to feel like it. You can feel a different way, because I never had that. And that's not particular to my parents at all, or even the religion. I think that was quite normal for that generation as well. You do as you're told, don't question things. But also because I grew up within that faith where I was told the answers before I could ask the questions. And so if I asked the questions, it was like, well, you know this answer already. Why are you asking this question? And I think questions were a really valid thing.
Yeah, I agree. Also, I think it's interesting what you're saying about sex, because you know what? I think you're right. I think regardless of whether you grow up in a religious or a conservative household, families just don't talk about sex, or at least they didn't. I think now it's different. Mm-hmm. I think social media has really normalized the idea of talking about these things at home. But, you know, I came from a very liberal family. My family never spoke to me about sex, ever. The first time I learned about sex was, again, like from friends, and it's stuff that people, stories that people tell you, and it's, you know, putting a condom on a banana at school. I think just talking openly about these things could solve a lot of problems.
Absolutely.
Now we've got a bit of a deeper understanding about life as a witness. I want to return to the book and the relationship between Anna and Nick. Would you mind explaining a bit about, so we know a bit about Anna's background, obviously, but talk to me a bit about Nick and the kind of contrast between their two upbringings and whether a relationship like that would be possible, and what the reaction to that would be like in real life.
Within the faith?
Yeah.
Yeah. So with Nick, I wanted to, so he comes from a place of deep-seated trauma. And in the book, it goes into what happened to him when he was a child and how these very emotionally traumatic events shaped him as a person. And so a main part of Anna and Nick's relationship is that there isn't really a relationship, because they're never properly able to voice what they think and how they feel about each other. They're always waiting for the other person to make the first move, which I think that's quite true to life, I think, for a lot of people. From Anna's perspective, this is obviously because of the faith that she's within, and she knows that she's having feelings for an unbeliever, which she really can't do. And so although she's quite a forthright person, that is what holds her back. For Nick, what holds him back is his trauma. And he's never actually had somebody there who has been able to show him how to talk about his feelings, how to deal with his trauma in the first place. So I was interested in that from how these two people who come from very different lives and are actually two very different types of people fundamentally still have the same problem. They're unable to really voice how they feel. That relationship just would not have been allowed. It's not allowed within the witness community. So as a witness, you go to school and you go to work, but you do not associate with what they call worldly people. So you, after work, after school, you go straight home. You don't socialize. You keep contact to an absolute bare minimum because your world really is everything within the faith, and everything outside of it is you just don't go there. So Anna in the book is sort of pushing at these boundaries as she's getting to know Nick and having this kind of relationship with him. And there is a scene where he, because he comes from a family life that wasn't particularly happy, he is naturally averse to the idea of marriage and of having children and anything that kind of reeks of that sort of traditional role, gender roles, relationships, really. And for Anna, of course, within her faith, that she has no choice. If she stays within her faith, it has to meet this traditional pattern. And so for her, he says that he never wants to get married. So she kind of knows that the relationship ultimately is never going to go anywhere. And of course, they're both incredibly young. I mean, she's like 19 and he's in his early 20s. So to him, it's like, why are we even talking about this anyway? We're both so young. But to her, it's like, I have no other choice. So within the faith, if you had a relationship with an unbeliever, it would be very frowned upon, and you would most likely be what's called marked, which is where at the Kingdom Hall, there would be what's called a marking talk, where they would talk about a topic. So for example, if this was going on in the congregation, they would give a talk about how witnesses should not have relationships with unbelievers. That is the wrong thing to do. The Bible says this, that you should be not yoked unevenly with unbelievers. And so this is not allowed. And although they wouldn't say the person's name within the talk who was guilty of this, it would sort of be known who the person was. And by giving this talk, you're ultimately marking that person, which means that people within the congregation should limit their contact with that person. So someone could be in the religion and going to the meetings and only know these people within the faith, but these people will draw away from them all the while that they are entertaining the idea of having a relationship with an unbeliever. And it's only if they were to end that relationship that everyone within the faith would allow them to socialize with them again. So there was a, you know, there is a very kind of tight system of control within that. So that relationship could happen, but they would absolutely have to get married. There could be no living together, no premarital sex, like absolutely not.
And presumably would Nick have to convert and become a witness and practice that?
Not necessarily. They could still get married. It would still be very frowned upon, and witness friends would be spoken to if they thought about going to the wedding, for example, because they would be showing their support for it by going to the wedding. So it would most likely be a very quiet affair. You know, they'd just go to a registry office or something. There wouldn't be a big party. And then ultimately the unbeliever, it would always be encouraged that they should come along to meetings and have a Bible study and ultimately become a witness. And that has happened. So growing up, there were always stories of this happening, that people would then come into what they called the truth later by studying. But also there were often, and it was usually if there was a couple who were married in this way, where one believed and one didn't, it would usually be the woman who was the believer and the man would be the unbeliever. It would be rare or much less frequent that it would be the other way around.
I want to ask you a bit more generally about how religion kind of influences relationships, because we have spoken about this a bit on the podcast before, but I think, you know, a lot of the things you're talking about can be applied to people who are raised with any set of beliefs, any religion. You know, I think, for example, I mentioned this before we started recording, but like my family is Jewish, and there was very much this kind of like unspoken promise that, you know, you marry a Jewish person. Obviously that often hasn't happened in my family, but that's kind of the expectation. So it's like you said, it's like frowned upon. So when it comes to kind of navigating that, do you have any advice for people who are kind of overcoming those cultural hurdles and overcoming family disapproval of the person who they're in love with? Because that can obviously be an incredibly traumatizing experience, because then you feel like you have to choose between your partner or your family.
Yeah, I mean, I find myself completely unqualified to give any kind of actual advice. But I mean, for me, stepping away from my community because of listening to how I really felt about things has been, without a doubt, you know, the hardest thing I've ever done. It's been extremely traumatic, because it's not a faith that you can just really leave and still keep hold of all the relationships that you have with people inside of it. And so I have family and friends who have completely cut me off and no longer have anything to do with me. So I kind of feel that giving advice is something that I just couldn't do, because I think it's so personal. And I know many witnesses, for example, and I'm sure it's the same with many religions, who are within the faith, who necessarily probably don't actually believe it or don't completely believe it, have strong doubts. But because it's so hard to leave and keep hold of the love of the people that you love, that they just stay within it and they just ignore those doubts and they just stay quiet about it. So I don't judge those people at all. Even though I've made the step of stepping out, I don't think any less of those people, because I know how hard it is. And I think that overcoming family disapproval is a very easy thing to talk about if you don't have experience of it. But if you do, it's just so personal. I think for me, all I can do is talk about my experience, which is I'm glad I listened to my doubts, because I feel that I'm now living life consciously in a way that I didn't, and that the decisions that I make now, I give a lot more thought to them, because I'm not constantly on autopilot and I'm always thinking about what I believe and what I think about a certain subject. And if I feel like I'm in a way, without this sounding really disrespectful to my previous community, I feel like I'm living life strangely for the first time, because as a witness, your life right now doesn't matter. The life that you will have, a mortal life on a paradise earth after Armageddon, that's the life you care about. And because I now no longer cling to that belief, because I'm not sure of what I believe, I'm embracing this life more. And it feels wonderful, to be honest. It feels absolutely wonderful to be seeing things for the first time in a new way. It feels like the Truman Show, without sounding really cheesy. I watched that again recently and it really struck me. It was really emotional watching it, because you have a choice. You know, if you've seen the film, spoiler alert, but if you've seen the film, Truman's standing on that staircase and he's touching the studio wall, and he's got the film director, the TV director, Christoph, talking to him and saying, look, stay, you know, you're not going to get hurt here. We're going to look out for you. You're fine. You know, he's saying, even though you know this isn't real, just stay and you will have a better life. And Truman ultimately walks out the door because he would rather find out for himself, even if he does get hurt, he would rather find out for himself what is truth, what feels real to him, what feels honest. That's very much how I feel. I miss all of those people that I left behind and I wish I could still be with them. But this is ultimately my life. And just as I would never tell them how to live, I can't tell my children how to live. I can't. It has to be our own individual decisions. So I think I would say to someone in that situation, you have to listen to your gut and listen to your instinct and try and trust that, and hopefully the love that you have with your family and your friends will be stronger than the fear, will be stronger than what society thinks of you. I mean, that's what you always hope for your family, isn't it, that their love goes deeper than society.
I think that's such a powerful metaphor and comparison to make, the Truman Show, because, like, you know, I think most people have seen that film and it's like you immediately get it. for people who might be feeling like they can't relate, but I think that is such a powerful way of putting it into perspective. It's time for our Lessons in Love segment. So this is the part of the show where I ask every guest to share something they've learned from their previous relationship experiences. Jodie, what is your lesson in love? Do you have any new lessons to share?
I would say, what would I say? I mean, listen to your gut and instinct is definitely one. But also, I think for me, what I have learned through relationships is that one of the most important things when you go into a relationship and the success of any relationship is that your expectations are the same. So for you and the other person, that you both have the same expectations of what you want in terms of how you live your relationship or how you live your life. I think fundamentally, disappointment happens and relationships ultimately fail a lot of the time if one person has wildly different expectations to the other person. I think if you can find a way to make sure that your expectations match, personally, I think that that is half the battle.
Yeah, that's so true. I think that could be applied to anything as well, because it could be something as big as, you know, whether or not you want children, to something as like, you know, where do you want to live? You know, I think if you're not aligned on those things, you need to find out soon rather than get too deep in, you know, that you always need to have like a meeting and be like, right, check. Yeah. Because unromantic as that sounds, I think that would probably eliminate a lot of pain for a lot of couples.
I think so. And actually, one thing I would add to that is I watched a School of Life YouTube video. I can't remember the guy who does it.
Alan de Botton.
That's it.
Is that him? Okay.
He's brilliant. Yeah, he's got such a great voice. Yeah, and one thing he said, which I thought was brilliant in terms of having a relationship with someone else, is thinking of your partner as like a pie and dividing them up into different segments. Think of your ideal partner and all the different segments. You know, it could be a sense of humor. It could be being kind, all of these kind of things. And think to yourself, you're never going to get someone that's a complete pie. You're never going to meet that person. So really think about the segments of the pie that are most important to you. What are the parts that you are not willing to compromise on? And then use that as a way of testing whether someone would actually be your ideal partner, whether or not they have those essential segments. When I watched that video, I was like, wow, that's brilliant. That could just solve so many problems.
Oh my God, I love that. To incomplete pies.
That's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you're a new listener to this show, you can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or anywhere else. You can comment and leave us a rating too, so that more people can find us. Keep up to date with everything to do with the show on Instagram. Just search Millennial Love. See you soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.